This episode is brought to you by Thorn, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorn is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorn.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorn. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. This episode is sponsored by a company I've used for well over a decade, and that is 5.11. I wore their uniforms back in Anaheim, California, and have used their products ever since. From their incredibly strong yet light footwear to their cut uniforms for both male and female responders, I found them hands down the best workwear in all the departments that I've worked for. Outside of the fire service, I use their luggage for everything and I travel a lot, and they are also now sponsoring the 7X team as we embark around the world on the Human Performance Project. We have MRF coming up in May, and again, I bought their plate carrier. I ended up buying real ballistic plates rather than the fake weight plates, and that has been my ride or die through MRF the last few years as well. But one area I want to talk about that I haven't in previous sponsorship spots is their brick and mortar element. They were predominantly an online company up till more recently, but now they are approaching 100 stores all over the US. My local store is here in Gainesville, Florida, and I've been multiple times. And the discounts you see online are applied also in the stores. So as I mentioned, 5.11 is offering you 15% off every purchase that you make. But I do want to say, more often than not, they have an even deeper discount, especially around holiday times. But if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, you will get 15% off your order or in the stores every time you make a purchase. And if you want to hear more about 5.11, who they stand for and who works with them, listen to episode 580 of Behind the Shield podcast with 5.11 regional director, Will Ayers. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show Layla and Ali Rogan and Troy Dishard. Now, I'm so excited to bring you this conversation because it is such a great example of the absolute imperative nature of training in the first responder professions. On May 22nd, 2022, Layla was riding an ATV and had a near-fatal accident resulting in a massive TBI. As you will hear from the events that followed, from the Good Samaritan that initially found her, the high level of training the first responders had, the continued chain of care in the hospital, and extending into the therapy side. Another essential part of this conversation is simply to underline the danger of ATVs when not ridden properly in the right area. So I hope this serves as a cautionary tale, obviously from the side of safety, but also diligence in training in the first responder professions. Now, before we get to this amazing conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 900 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Layla and Allison Rogan and Troy Deschard. Enjoy. Well, Layla, Ali, and Troy, I want to start by saying thank you all so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're fans, so this was a cool opportunity.
Beautiful. Well, let's start with Layla and Ali. Where on planet Earth are we finding you guys this afternoon?
Wellington, Florida.
And where is that close to?
West Palm Beach. Yeah. Oh, I'm in there.
Beautiful. And what about you, Troy?
I'm same, West Palm Beach, Florida.
All right. Well, let's stay with Troy for a second. I just want to get some of your kind of story into the fire service, and then we'll switch over to the Rogan family and start walking through, you know, Ali's journey and beyond. So, Troy, when did you begin the fire service?
I started in 2005, pretty much right out of high school. I knew what I wanted to do. Went to fire academy, EMT and paramedic school. Was lucky enough to get picked up by Palm Beach County in 2005, and the rest is history. I'll be finishing my 19th year here in a few months, and I've risen through the ranks. Did some time on Trauma Hawk, our helicopter, which I'm sure you'll hear a little bit about. And now I currently am an EMS captain for Palm Beach County Fire Rescue, we oversee all of the EMS activities, all the paramedics in our response area, our battalion. And there's 9 of us on duty each day.
Fantastic. All right. Just want to give some kind of backstory before we get to that point. So, Ali, talk to me about kind of, you know, your journey prior to having children. You know, what were the professions that you were in? And then talk to me about, you know, the birth of your child.
Prior to kids, I thought I was going to go to, be an artist or something in the field. I went to art school for college and then landed in finance somehow and then became a mom. So it did kind of change all of that. I wasn't very good at it, to be honest, but my whole path changed. Like, I loved being a parent, I think, more than I've ever loved anything. So I went from saying I'm never having children to having 3 children. And I said I was never getting married, and I did that as well. Never seen.
Let's go to you, Layla, then, and kind of walk through your early life. So things I like to ask people, firstly, what about sports and athletics? What were you playing kind of prior to the incident?
What did I do before dance, or just dance?
Just start with that.
Okay, I did dance until I was 5.
5, 6.
5, 6. And then who told me to do cheer?
A neighbor.
A neighbor told me to do cheer, all-star cheer. And I just tried it out and I fell in love with it. And I did cheer for 5 to 13, so 8 years. And then I quit and did just private lessons. I didn't do season. And then I got my accident, so I can't go back. Well, I can, I'm gonna, but I couldn't go back then. So yeah, I've basically done cheer and dance my whole life.
Like gymnastics, a lot of gymnastics stuff in there.
It's not really gymnastics, but okay.
So what about the switch to privates then? What made you make that switch, and what did you get out of that you didn't from the other group that you were with?
Well, it's because my gym had 2 locations and they opened one that was in Coconut Creek. This is the gym. Where is it? This is a gym. And they opened one in Wellington here. And so I went there and then I was there 3 years and then they closed. So they were closed. So like they moved to Coconut Creek, which is a little far from me. It's like an hour. And I was like, I'm not driving that much 3 times a week, if more, because I have to do classes and stuff. So I just stopped doing it. Nobody did lessons, so I don't have to go back once a week. And then I just, yeah, I tried out and I literally found out what team I made the day of my accident. It was the highest level I've ever been on too.
Now, what about career aspirations? When you were the same kind of age, what were you dreaming of becoming when you graduated?
I used to want to be a business manager. I didn't know what company, what I wanted to be a business manager of.
But you used to say your own.
I wanted to be in charge. Yeah, I just wanted to be in charge. But then after my accident, I want to be a physical therapist now or somebody along with the medical field. Like, I want to be in there. But yeah.
All right. Well, staying with Layla then, walk me through the day of May 22nd, 2022. So the events prior to the accident, and then we'll get to the accident itself.
You know, that's a great question. I don't exactly remember it. I have no from what I've been told. What I've been told was I woke up that morning. It was a normal morning and she went to the beach and I asked her to come get me. And then she said after the beach and I was okay. So I went on the ATV to like take time, like make up time, whatever. And then I got in my accident. But yeah, that's all I know. Oh, purple.
Well, Ali, then, I know we talked before, so walk me through what you've heard as far as how that day actually panned out, and then let's get to the accident itself, and then we'll bring Troy in through the EMS eyes.
Yeah, so she was actually supposed to come to the beach with us, but she was with friends, and she said she'd get a ride there. So we went until I got a phone call that said, the person, I couldn't hear them on the phone, so I tracked her on a location app and I could see where she was. I knew somebody who lived local to where her spot was. And I said, can you open your door? Tell my daughter to answer her phone. And they said, she's probably watching the big ATV accident that just happened down the street. And we just knew. So he said, they're med flighting her to St. Mary's, just get there. And there was another bystander who was with her prior to paramedics getting there who had, he was an army medic, a former army medic, that he found her. He was the one on the 911 call that said, you know, she has agonal respirations. You need everything here, like all resources. So he did reposition her and get her somewhat breathing normally again until paramedics got there.
And what have you been told as far as the events leading up, you know, how she find herself on the ATV, you know, was there a helmet, you know, just kind of the details of the events prior.
She was not wearing a helmet. Her dad actually said to her when he dropped her at the house the day before, don't get on that ATV. It will bite you, was the last words he said to her. And she did it anyway. And so it was fast. It was like, I don't know how fast they normally go, but from what I understood, she was going probably about 50, 55 miles an hour, no helmet. Took a turn too fast, lost control, tried to correct, and went into the back of a parked SUV.
Brutal. Absolutely brutal. Well, Troy, so talk to me about getting toned out, you know, what your position was at that point, and then what you saw when you arrived.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was actually at the fire station that responded to Layla's call. And these types of accidents would get my response anyways. Anything involving an ATV, a motorcycle, anything like that, typically an EMS captain is dispatched with it. So I happened to be right at the station when the call came in, came in, went out to the truck and saw the notes on the call. At the same time, another EMS captain in a neighboring battalion was also kind of close by. So he assigned himself as well. So we continued going, and I could tell through the dispatcher's voice as information kept coming in. Now there's two patients, you know, one of them's, you know, unresponsive with agonal breathing, and it didn't sound good at all. And you know, the vehicle that I drive is a truck or an SUV. We can go a little bit faster than the rescues and the engines do. So, you know, a little inside joke for me, I'm like, you know, I'm not used to being first on scene of these types of calls. You know, my role coming in is usually, to assist and to augment the crews that are already on scene starting stuff. So I'm not normally a first responder. I'm at least a second responder. Today, I was a first responder on this day where I rounded the corner with that other EMS captain who was directly in front of me. And there was no rescue behind us right away. So we were the first two people there. And being that there were two patients, we each kind of went to work. I was lucky enough to come across Layla first. She was in rough shape. She's, being cared for by that, the Army medic first responder that was there. I've been doing this a while now where I can, look at a patient and go sick or not sick. And Layla was sick, quickly realizing, okay, this is what we have. She's going to meet our trauma alert criteria. She's, severely injured. The other patient was as well, and trying to communicate all that information back. It seems like, 10 or 15 minutes. It was probably only maybe a minute or two before the rescue and the engine and everybody else showed up to help. But it just seems so much, slower. Time slows down when you have a critical patient like that. We got to work. Layla was the priority of the two, and we triaged really rapidly. And between me and the other captain there, we decided that Layla needed to go first. Once the team got there, we loaded her up and did our thing.
You said there was two patients. Was the other one on the ATV as well, or were they a bypasser? ATV as well. Okay. Gotcha. So, firstly, as far as initial assessment, what were you seeing by that point? Some kind of vitals have been relayed by the medic.
It was very surreal because obviously he didn't have any equipment. He was trained and told over the 911 phone to don't move her, leave her there, which is probably the best thing. He did roll her so that she was bleeding a lot from her face. He rolled her to her, left her there and rolled her head to the side so that all that fluid would drain out. So that was a huge plus, but, she was unresponsive. She was breathing on her own, albeit, with a lot of facial injuries. I'm not used to seeing patients. We do training like this where, we'll have EMS competitions where a patient will be in these precarious situations. Layla was still laying face down on the hood on the front of the ATV. So that's exactly what he was told to do. Don't move her. Leave her right where she is. Normally, the patient's on the ground, or by the time I get there, they may already be in the back of the rescue. With me arriving very quickly, we go into our triage mode and trying to assess and do that type of thing. But Layla was in bad shape. We got her off the ATV, put her on a long spine board, put a collar around her neck, and I immediately directed somebody to assist her ventilations, which is something that we train for and that we do regularly. And my role then, I step back and I start kind of directing the call and how things are supposed to go and what needs to get done. All of that's happening as we're loading her into the back of the truck and we're headed to the landing zone where we had our helicopter coming in. She's, a trauma patient, and our trauma center from where the accident was is probably a good 30 to 40 minute drive by ground. She couldn't wait that long. So we called for our helicopter. They were on the way to the landing zone. And everything happened very, very quickly, but methodically. Calls that, these are calls that we run all the time. They just don't always have such good outcomes.
Do you have the ability to RSI in your county?
We do. We call it DSI, delayed sequence induction or intubation. It's something that all of our lieutenants and our paramedics are thoroughly trained on. I carry the paralytic on my truck. So I bring that to the call. But all of that stuff was happening. You know, we ended up doing IOs on Layla, which is the needle that goes right into the bone, to get access. And Layla's heard all this. She very interested in all this stuff. I was shocked at that. But so we ended up getting that in, and then of course making sure that her oxygen saturation is where it needs to be, and she's stabilized there, and her blood pressure is where it needs to be, and that's adequate enough just to perform the procedure. A lot of the training that we've done, and all of the advancement that my agency brings to the table, is that we've realized and we've learned that the procedure itself can be harmful to patients if we don't set them up, you know, with their hemodynamics and their oxygenation status ahead of time. You know, fortunately, that wasn't the challenging part of Layla's case. You know, her blood pressure was maintaining at the time. And her oxygen saturation was being corrected and fixed, you know, with suctioning and all of that stuff. So that was being taken care of. You know, it was Layla's head injury that I felt was going to be, you know, the challenging part of her. You know, we didn't know about any of the other unforeseen injuries that she ended up having. But, you know, when I see patients like Layla and she was posturing, and doing, you know, things that in the past, you know, very devastating brain injury patients do. It's not been a very positive outcome. So it was also that was on my mind. I'm, you know, preparing the crew and letting them, you know, okay, look, we're doing everything that we can do. But just so we all understand, this is an extremely critical, very, very bad injury, you know, because that's another aspect of my job, is making sure that, you know, the crew gets the support and the, you know, the CISD and all of that stuff that happens after the fact as well.
With you having critical care experience already and already working on the helicopter, what are some of the things that you did or you could, you know, advise medics out there that would set the crew on the helicopter up for success with this kind of injury?
Well, absolutely. My goal is to make sure when the helicopter crew arrives, from being on the other side, my goal now is to make sure that this patient is set up ready for them. You know, that everything that can be done is done or is almost done by the time that they get there. I don't want to be behind the eight ball. And that just speeds everything else up. So, you know, obviously knowing that her airway is going to need to be controlled. That was, you know, with the massive amount of facial injuries that she had, the bleeding that was going on there and the head injury that she had, it is not ideal to do any of that in the back of an aircraft. That's very difficult to do. So I knew that needed to get done. You know, that information was relayed to them to expect an intubated patient, that allows them to, if they're going to use the ventilator, they can set that up. They can have all that ready to go. Allows them to, you know, be prepared for post sedation drugs that are going to need to be given after the fact, those types of things. And as I recall, as they walked in, you know, one of the flight medics, Frank, showed up and he walked right in the door. He's like, "What do we got?" And we were in the middle of actually placing the tube at that point. So she had already received her sedation. She had already been chemically paralyzed, and the intubation was moving along pretty quick. So that's, you know, something that I have a lot of experience with. To me, I felt that was going to be the most challenging part of it, which it was. But it was something that I knew had to be done before she could be loaded for the helicopter.
So it was a good job that it was you that responded at that point and not someone that maybe had, I mean, not, you know, being critical at all, but someone with critical care experience arriving first versus
we have a very good group. of EMS captains. You know, all of us, you know, many of us were on the helicopter at one point. You know, I would have been really comfortable with our group of people, but that's why they send us to those calls. You know, our group is we train on this all the time. We train new people on this all the time. Our lieutenants and our paramedics go through this training on a regular basis. And I do this with my crews. And that's why, you know, one of the things that I've used now since Layla's case is it validates why we train so hard and do what we do and why I kind of have a high standard for this type of stuff. I don't want to pat myself on the back because I do think anybody could have done the same thing, you know, in my position. But it's like those things, you know, you don't want to see these types of calls happen. But when I, you know, if they're going to happen, I want to be there because I feel like I can help.
Well, I think it underlines the importance of training no matter what rank you're in.
It's just 1,000%. And it's continuous, you know, I still train every, you know, every week I'm doing something with a crew somewhere, you know. You know, I float the county now. So it just allows me now to see more people than I used to with my own small battalion. Now I float the county. I'm in a different battalion every shift, which I enjoy, you know, and it just brings fresh, you know, perspectives into things. And, you know, I have had many of these calls since, you know, and for the most part, they all go pretty well. You know, there's some hiccups here or there, but training is key. If we don't train for it, then when it actually is game day and it's Layla's game, we're not going to do as well or be, you know, perform as well as we did.
Absolutely. Well, Ali, I want to bring you in a second from kind of the hospital on, but just one more thing for you, Troy. You hand off to the helicopter crew. Were there any challenges on that flight, or was it pretty, you know, smooth as far as their role?
It's very quick, and it's what I like more about being on the ground. And I loved flying; it's one of the best jobs I had. But the flight, everything happens so fast; it's super fast, and it just seems like you don't have enough time to get anything done that you want to get done. So, you know, being that everything had been done prior to them arriving, it made that transition very seamless. It's a team. So what I know I can't get to, I know they're going to do, you know, and if I give them a soup sandwich, the call, they have a lot to fix, or it's going to continue to be a soup sandwich. In this case, Layla was packaged with a bow and she was, everything was done, the best that I felt we could do it. So they had very little to do other than just provide supportive care, making sure that her vitals stayed fine and really getting her to the hospital as quickly as possible. And then that constantly is, you know, we set the table, they transported, they set their stuff up. So the hospital now is on, you know, on point to be able to just continue that. And if a call starts well, typically it ends well, vice versa. So I would like to think that I don't think they had any issues. I didn't hear of any. I think everything went fairly flawless for them as well. I'm sure they gave her some pain medication and further sedation on the way and got her to the hospital probably at less than 10-minute flight for them.
It was like nine. It was like almost on the nose, like the whole thing.
It's very fast, which was a challenge when I ended up going to the helicopter, you know. I don't think street medics are used to working that quickly. That was a challenge that I, you know, obviously I enjoyed at the time, is just getting to try having to do so much in such a short period of time. It's a luxury that, now that I'm on the ground, I realize it's completely different work.
I used to work about 10 minutes from our trauma center. So I can totally relate. Very, very small amount of time.
It's extremely fast paced, and, you know, and now we've added in further things, you know, we're doing blood in the field and doing those types of things as well, which, Layla may have been a candidate for as well. At the time we weren't carrying that. But now, you know, we're just continually to progress as the science and as, EMS as a whole around the world is progressing. Yeah, they're just adding more and more things for us to do, life-saving things, awesome things. So hopefully continue to keep up with the trends.
Beautiful. All right. Well, Ali, so you are on the phone. She might be watching that ATV accident. Walk me through how that gets you to the hospital. And then, you know, what were you receiving as far as some of the diagnosis by that point?
My friend went over and confirmed it was Layla and said they're taking her to St. Mary's. And we were a lot closer to St. Mary's than they were. They were by our house. We were east. So we packed up as fast as we could, headed to the hospital. We actually got there simultaneous with the helicopter. We saw her land. And I've seen them, but you don't really think about what's happening until it's happening to your person or you. And so she landed. I didn't even know the protocol. Like, I assumed, you know, I can just run up in there and hug my daughter. And no, that's not the case. You have to go inside. And so they brought us to the trauma bays, which I had never seen that before. And she was out, you know, she had everything he described, you know, she was intubated, which I never even knew what that was for before that day or understood it. She had the neck brace on. She was unresponsive. She looked like she was sleeping, but very beaten, you know, very, very beaten. And when they came in, I think they had scanned her, but they hadn't done the MRI yet. But she had, they warned us there's multiple brain bleeds. They kept telling us about a dissected carotid artery. She had damage to the right carotid. I didn't even know what your carotid artery did before that day. I don't even think I did know that day. I was just they were just coming at us with her jaw's broken. There's internal bleeding. There's liver damage. The brain bleeds. And like, then before we knew it, we're going to move her upstairs to ICU. We're going to drill into her skull and put this monitor in there to monitor the pressure. And if the brain swells, which we were told was likely would happen with that kind of injury, then they would have to cut the skull open and relieve the pressure. But then I know this now because I've gone back and researched it. But then, like, we didn't know what they were saying. It was just thing after thing of medical jargon that I had never heard of. I didn't know that there was a trauma wing of the hospital. Like, you just don't think about it until you're living it. Like, it was so much new information for us and new places. And, you know, then from there, after a few days, she didn't swell, which they kind of made it sound like it wasn't necessarily a good thing. It wasn't how one would respond with that type of injury. So they removed it. They did the MRI and we were told she had a diffused axonal injury, which they grade them on a 1 to 3, 3 being severe damage to the stem and not a good outcome typically, and Layla was a 3. So it was just like, you know, there was just no good news, honestly. It was just like best case scenario, she lives and more than likely will remain unconscious is what we were told.
So with the dissection of the carotid artery, I mean, that sounds absolutely horrendous. When they kind of went deeper into that, was it just a slight lesion then as opposed to, you know, a severe? Because I mean, you'd think you'd literally bleed out in seconds if that was truly dissected.
The way they explained it to me, it's like the walls are almost shredded and torn.
Okay.
So what's more likely to happen is blood clots and strokes. But they really couldn't address it because how they would normally address it was through blood thinners. They couldn't do blood thinners because her brain was bleeding. So it was kind of like, this could kill her. This could also kill her. It's just what's going to kill her first is how it felt. And then we kind of, like, she still has the dissected carotid artery. She'll probably have it her whole life. In a perfect world, it never has to have any intervention, but we've been prepared. You know, she could need a stent when she's older at some point, as long as it's kind of a mystery why it's not causing issues. They still haven't fully understood that, but same thing with her healing and recovery. Like, it just makes no sense.
Good. I'm glad it doesn't.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then for the family side, because at this point, obviously, Layla's still unconscious. So talk to me about the emotional impact of this. One minute, your daughter is literally out having the time of her life. The next minute, you're sitting in a trauma center.
It's like there's really not words that can even describe that. It's such a physical pain. Like, you hurt all over when it's your kid. Like, it was just so physical and so overwhelming. Like, you can't breathe. You just can't function. And it was but you also at the same time kind of go into a denial. Like, there was I had one of my friends who was with us during it. She's like, they were telling you like these horrible things and you were just like, she's going to be okay. Right. Like, I just couldn't accept this was how this was going to end. Like, you almost do it to protect yourself. But then, you know, typically doctors were making rounds and reiterating it to us. So eventually you start to come to grips with, they told us to make our peace. Like, I guess the first 72 hours are pretty critical, and usually when they lose them. So they were saying, bring in the family, bring in the siblings, like, let give people the chance to say goodbye. And I couldn't do it. I just couldn't. I couldn't accept it. It was just not, it didn't feel like this is how that was supposed to end. Like, there was no way you could even make peace with that. You can, 72 hours is not enough time. Like, there was no way.
Well, I think trending is so important when it comes to, you know, injury and illness. And, you know, if she's continuing to spiral down, then obviously that's not a good sign at all. At what point did they realize that it was either staying where it was or slight improvements were happening, conversely to what they were fearing?
It was probably at least a week and a half, and probably closer to 2 weeks. She first was neurostorming, which is where the body won't regulate heartbeat and blood pressure, and her temperature, she would spike really high, and they would throw like you would put like fish on ice is what they were doing to my daughter. They would just pack her with ice. Her skin was like rock hard because it was just so cold. Temperature would come down, fever would go back up. I mean, it just, that was our cycle for so long. And that's usually when you lose them, it's through those things. But like, she just kept getting to the next day and getting to the next day. I mean, I think that they at one point thought, okay, vitals are strong. She's probably going to live, but I don't think they anticipated she was going to wake up and talk and walk and do any of that. I mean, that's what waking up from a coma can look like for some. And that's like, we didn't get that, you know, to us, like the movies, someone's in a coma and they wake up and they're confused, but they're talking and they're everything's back to normal. And it's not the case at all. They lie to you in the movies because it's very, it could be, it looks different for everyone. And for her, it was just, she's probably going to remain vegetative, and but she's alive. And like, the next step was, okay, how do we prepare for her future care? So it was like each step that she got to, we had to like learn, this is what our life will look like now. But then she would the next day do something else. And I think it was, I want to say 2 weeks in, when she started moving, like the fingers, the toes. And we would ask her all the time, but she never did it. And she started responding with like toe wiggling and fingers moving, and but still very unresponsive, still in a coma. Like, she was still in a coma for up to, it was 5 weeks before they labeled her emerged. No. It's crazy. It's like not at all what they tell you on TV. That was like the biggest thing to me. And I kept saying like, how can you not fix this? And they just, there's so little they know about the brain. And I was so frustrated. Like, this is America. How do we not know how to fix this? I think I said that to like several doctors. Like, why isn't there a medicine? Why isn't there something? Like, why can't you fix this? And they said like the brain is like the most, there's so many unknowns there, and everyone is different. And some wake up and most don't. And you just don't know. It's a roll of the dice. You don't know what you're going to get.
I've made that very comment a lot when I look back at my career, because I just was the black cloud, as we call it in the fire service. And everyone that went into cardiac arrest, not the precos to save loads of those, but the ones that went into cardiac arrest, I never saved a single person in 14 years, which is brutal, because you do all the training and they're like, James, if you just do this, this, and this, then you get the sinus rhythm, and then they get up and they bake you a cake and they come to the fire station and everyone hugs on the newspaper. Nope. So, you know, when you look at the way that we are educated in medicine, sometimes it is you do A, B, and C, and outcome D will be the result. And it can set us up for failure, you know, operationally and emotionally. And I think it's the same with the average person. We show up on an engine or a rescue, we come out with all our gear, you put the pads on, like, why isn't my grandmother waking up? Because we've set these false expectations. So it's interesting you say that, because you're absolutely right. And even in the firefighter documentaries, it's always the rescues, it's always the saves, which is a very, very small part of our actual, you know, cardiac arrest survival.
Yeah, my son is actually a firefighter, and he had just, he was 19 when he started his career, and about three months before her accident. So he was, you know, dealing with the whole experience of being new, and he would call the stress, and it was very stressful. And here's my 19-year-old son who's calling me every third day after shift and just unloading all the things he saw and did. And it was like, I felt like we went right from that, and I'm trying so hard to support him and be there for him. And then this happens to his sister. So it was like all the calls he described to me. And I remember, I think like, there's no way they're letting my 19-year-old son do and see these things. And then I'm thinking, maybe, you know, he's not getting it right. Maybe I'm not understanding it right. And then I'm living it, you know, 3 months later, I'm like, wow, he wasn't kidding. This is horrible. Like, this is some bad stuff you're going to see on these calls.
Absolutely. It must have been terrible for him, you know, knowing, you know, the outcomes in the real world of some of these accidents.
Yeah. And he was really just trying to like prove himself to the department. And like, we knew, you know, the first year he'd be on probation, and we were trying to like just support him through it. And then it was impossible. Like, it was impossible to support him. And then we're dealing with this. And so we had to kind of put him on the back burner. He took it in stride, and he's a great kid, but not, he's almost 22 and I still say that, but he's still a little baby to me. And he did. I mean, it was a tough year because he didn't really have us as present, and he was trying so hard to like comfort us. And, you know, he like grew up overnight. I felt like my little boy was a completely different, he wasn't a little boy anymore because of it. Like, he had to, and he did come and see her, and he knew those machines, and he knew the medications. I didn't know. Like, my ignorance was almost bliss because I didn't understand any of it. To me, it was like, okay, she's here. She's alive. So this has to be okay. And he knew, you know, he understood the medicine side behind all the equipment and the machines. And it was hard for him. It was really hard.
That's got to be even worse sometimes, because, you know, knowing too much.
Yes.
Oh, hurts you sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. And he didn't even like, he was so scared to like tell the department and ask for time off. And I was like, what are you doing? Like, this is serious. And he takes his job very seriously. So it was not, her timing was terrible on that. We were supposed to be like,
It was right before summer. I didn't miss any school. You're welcome.
Well, that time he was
I knew what I was doing.
Yeah. She timed it well as far as school. Mm-hmm. She didn't miss any school.
Well, one more area of that dynamic before we move on. I've had quite a few people now who have had children either with accidents or with, you know, some sort of cancer or, you know, something horrendous where it needed a lot of the parents' attention, a lot of, you know, time in hospital, a lot of visiting specialists. And they had to be very aware of the attention being drawn from the other siblings as well. What was that juggling like? Because of course, Layla is your number one priority because she's fighting for her life, but you still have two other children as well.
Yeah, it was easier. My son made it easy, but my little one, you know, she was 10 at the time. And, you know, she's old enough to know something's really wrong, but too young to understand how bad this was. And she's very attached to me. So it was a lot of separation. That was almost harder than watching Layla go through everything, because she was just in so much pain and just repeatedly begged, her exact words over and over, I just want our old life back. I just want our old life back. And I couldn't promise her that. You know, I knew chances are it's never going to look like our old life. But I knew we'd figure it out. We'd find our norm. We would get there eventually. Like, she really wanted to be involved in like helping with her sister. She's super empathetic. And I didn't think she could handle even seeing her like that. Like, I couldn't bear that until Layla was talking and functioning a little bit better. So that was almost harder than Layla is dealing with the little one. It's horrible. Like, and I'd stress that to other people going through it. Don't forget the little ones, because it is hard. It is hard.
Okay.
Layla likes all the attention, even when she doesn't have a brain injury.
All right. Well, then let's walk through. You mentioned about, you know, 5 weeks and you're starting to see the emergence now. Walk me through what you witnessed, and then let's bring Layla in as far as, you know, her experience when she finally came around, was conscious enough to start processing what was going on.
Yeah. So the title emerged as what they use when you're waking up from a coma. So I'm thinking, again, it's the day she opens her eyes and she can walk and talk, but her eyes are open. There is just like no one's there. So they bring you in. We had our med flighted to a hospital in Georgia, a rehab that specializes in her injury. And they said, we're going to do CRS testing, which stands for coma recovery scale. We want to see how awake she is. And until she gets to a certain level, then they say she's emerged, which means you're no longer in a coma. I'm like, she doesn't do anything measurable. I remember thinking like, what are you measuring? She doesn't talk. She doesn't walk. Like, I didn't get it. And it was something as simple as they held up a hairbrush and a ball. And they said, I mean, she had to be like taken out of the bed with a lift. She was in a wheelchair. She couldn't even pick her head up. Like everybody's holding different parts of her. And they said, Layla, can you look at the hairbrush? And it was just her eyes moving to the hairbrush was the first thing that they were like, look at the ball. Then they just kept moving on through the steps of, and then she got to a point where she could point that day to yes and no. And she knew, you know, things about her life, how many dogs she had. She knew her dog's name. And we were just shocked because if you saw the way she was just lying there so lifeless, I was like, she can't do any of this stuff. And then she could, you know, I guess we just never asked. So it was a matter of they knew more than we knew. And then you have to perform those tasks for 3 days. And then they label you emerged, which just basically means you can tolerate longer therapies. And then they start trying things like walking and eventually eating. I mean, it's not, the talking came way later. That was like towards the end. The walking actually came first.
Yeah, iPad, like texting.
Oh, yeah, she could text. She could communicate with text, but she was clearly really confused the first couple of weeks. I mean, she repeatedly asked us if she was dead. That was her favorite question. And she forgot everything. So like maybe 10 minutes was the length of her memory. And the same questions would start all over. Why are we here? Why do we have to do this? Am I dead? Why do the days feel like they were playing? Like she was very, very confused. But just as time went on, you could see the confusion start to clear. But I wouldn't even say she was like fully clear for probably at least 2 months. Like it was, it takes a while. And that was fast. She did it a lot faster than people typically do.
So Layla, your perspective, what are your earliest memories and kind of walk me through your perception, like, you know, your experience of not only how you were thinking in your memory, but also your physical body at that point?
I don't exactly remember it like at all. But I do remember wanting to be home, like she said. I kept like asking if I was dead, and I remember that. And I remember like just like feeling like so lost and not knowing what was going on and like who these people were. Like I saw a lot of people and I didn't know who they were and who were these like random people like so close to me. Like what are they doing?
And she forgot her dad one day. I didn't know who her dad was.
I don't know her his feelings.
So then
speaking back.
So what could you do at that point then? I mean, could you swallow water? I mean, what was the worst part of you conscious?
Well, I had to be cleared for all these things. So it's not a matter of like, could I do them? It was like, if I'm allowed to, like it took a while for me to be cleared to eat Chick-fil-A nuggets. I got cleared for that. And I first was on a mashed potatoes diet. I don't like mashed potatoes, so yeah, egg bites.
A lot of egg bites.
Yeah, it's just there was like certain foods I could eat. Like, I definitely could do it. I just wasn't allowed to, so you wouldn't see me chowing down on a filet. But like, you know,
when you got cleared for Chick-fil-A, it wasn't on a Sunday, was it? That would have been really annoying.
I don't know what day it was.
Wait till Monday.
She was persistent too. Like as confused as she was, she would make me write it because she knew she'd forget it and say, ask Jen, who was our therapist, her physical therapist or her speech therapist, ask Jen for nuggets. And she would keep the note in the bed so that when she saw Jen,
I still
like,
do that. I still
and,
write things down.
You know, I want my nuggets. And they were like, not yet, not yet. So she was pretty determined to get those
and
nuggets.
Like, I'd always said like nuggets. Like, I'd always say that.
Well, what about the physical journey then? I mean, as you mentioned, you were a cheerleader, you were a gymnast. Now you're, you know, in a hospital bed in a wheelchair. When did you start realizing in your mind that you were going to get back on your feet? You were going to get back to cheer at some point?
It kind of wasn't like I started realizing it. I just like made like my work ethic that I wanted to get back. So that was like my motivation to like do everything. Like there's a video of like recently, it was like 6 months ago, of me doing back handsprings and stuff. That was only 6 months after my accident. Like you're doing, if you know what that is, it's a flip and cheer. And you go, like, it's like a backflip. And it's just like things like that. Like when I see those videos, I get like happy and excited because like I know I can do that. And like, it's just like kind of like a validation. Like, yeah, I can do that, you know?
So that was a huge milestone for you. What were some of the smaller ones before? I mean, you're still not cleared for chicken nuggets at this point. So what are some of the physical, you know, the walk, the jump, some of these other areas?
She was really determined to, like, you're not allowed to independent walk. This was a big fight.
Oh my gosh.
And she would just get up out of bed and, like, go get something across the room.
Because I could do it. I knew I could mentally do it.
She did know, but she wasn't allowed to. So there was many times, like, Layla, you can't just, well, I can do it. I'm like, I know.
Get up and go.
In front of the window.
Yeah, one time, like, I'm like parking her wheelchair and she didn't walk that well. Yeah. I'm parking the wheelchair and then I had to like do things to the bed before I transferred her in. And then I go to transfer and she's gone. Yeah. And she's at the window, like looking down, looking at Atlanta. And I'm like, ah! You know, she just did that stuff. And it made, I mean, everybody thought it was great. They're like, she's determined. That determination is what's going to get her out of here. And but I'm like, she's terrified me. Like, I don't know. What's okay and like what the consequences are if she does fall. Like
I don't fall. I don't fall.
So what about the normal trend then? I mean, I'm assuming that once they've got this treatment program for her, well, this is based on this kind of person. But as you mentioned, her injuries were such they weren't even sure she was going to survive. So as she's improving and kind of exceeding expectations, were they allowing her to do more and more?
Yeah, but I think like they really weren't, I mean, they're prepared for it, but at the same time, they weren't prepared for it. Like they frequently said to me, I mean, I had nurses break down crying. They're like, you know, we know it's possible. You read about that small percentage of someone who did this, but the fact that I not only met her, I got to work, I was her therapist. So it was, she was kind of a big deal there. It was funny, you know, people frequently would come to the room. They wanted to meet her. You know, this is the girl that did the impossible. Like with her injury, it doesn't end like this. And that's like, I joke and say she's false advertising because it just doesn't tip it. We've been working with other people with brain injury and I haven't seen anything like this where I'm like, there's no like protocol for it. That's like the problem
with
it.
There's nothing like
it. For sure.
One of a kind.
Stubborn.
Oh, yeah.
So what about the emotional side? I mean, again, you know, such a jarring event added in with a massive TBI, which we know can you know, upset some of the emotional side too. How, Layla, how were you able to navigate, you know, the challenges that you had and then get yourself back to where you are today?
Day by day?
All right, a lot of persistence.
I was stubborn. I still am stubborn.
To school when they said you shouldn't go back to school.
Oh, so funny story. my school. So I got home literally like a week before school started.
Days, whatever.
And so I like wanted to go back. Like not many kids want to go to school. I don't like school. Don't get me wrong. I do not like school. But I love academic validation. I love any validation, but academic validation, I love that. So it's just like, I wanted to go back and go back because I, before my accident, I was getting like strays, all this stuff. So like, I wanted to go back to that because like that felt really good. So I called my principal and I asked him, I was like,
against doctor's orders.
I was like, what are your thoughts about me coming back? Could I like figure this out? And then didn't he email you?
They called me and I didn't even know she had done that. She was still, when we got home, she was still like,
out of it.
She's out of it. There was a little confusion. It was a different daughter that, you know, I had before. And the school called and said, Layla contacted us about coming back. And I was like, what? You know, no, like, she's not cleared to do that. And so then we did. We brought her the neurologist. And I said, and she works her. She argues with him. He thinks it's hilarious. But she argued and argued. Everyone told her it was too soon. But she just.
2 weeks later.
2 weeks later, went back
to school.
I was
back. And I got all A's, B's, and C's. Then second quarter, A's and B's. Third quarter, A's and B's. Fourth quarter, A's and B's. Honor roll, 3 quarters last year. That's the most I've ever made in high school. Even my freshman year when I was like a genius, only 2 times.
Genius.
But sophomore year, the year when I was not very much in there at all, I made it 3 times. This year, I'm on track to make it 3 times again.
Amazing.
Just relax.
Determined. Real determined. And she was already on the sidelines cheering. That was one of her motivators.
Yeah,
she wanted to make the first game. She wanted to be there for the first cheerleading game. And I mean, not just be there, be in there. So they with every, I mean, we had so many accommodations. Like, it's just, there was nothing built for what she was doing. Typically people do like hospital homebound, where it's almost like a hybrid, where you're working from home or you're homeschooling. You're not going in person with this kind of injury, but she insisted and the school worked with us. They, I mean, every accommodation, some of them we had to like make up, because I was like, I don't even know if she can physically do what she thinks she can do. And it was hard, but she just kept getting better at it. But she's very determined with everything.
How were you received by your schoolmates and your teachers when you first went back to school?
Like a famous person.
Like a hero.
Yeah.
A celebrity.
Yeah. I don't really remember.
It's a little hazy, I think. I mean, yeah. We remember, but a lot of it she doesn't remember. But it was, I mean, to see the kids suffer, like her peers suffer, that was hard too, because kids just aren't built to process that. And especially when we thought we were going to lose it. And to see the kids going through this emotion that you know, they're going to potentially lose, you know, a classmate, and, you know, kids think they're invincible. So she made it, she made death real to them, you know, where kids don't think of that. And it, I felt like it changed like our whole community, her school, her friends, like everybody was so invested in this hopefully going to be a miracle. And I honestly like had my doubts, but it, you know, it worked out. And I felt like everyone celebrated that with us. Like, it really impacted so many people besides just our family.
I bet a lot of your friends were afraid to ask how your summer was, because your story was going to blow theirs out the water.
No, they knew. They didn't have to ask. They knew
what the summer was. Your college essay.
Yeah. Oh my God, I hear that all the time, where it's like, your college essay is going to be so good. I'm just thinking, like, what if I just like made a plot twist and didn't write my college essay on my accident, like something else? Like, I don't know.
I feel like you got it working.
Something inspiring. Something else I've done. Of all the things I've done, you know? Find someone else.
There we go. You're still young. Are you a junior or senior now?
Junior.
Junior. Same as my son.
Wow.
So
fun year.
So I want to talk about where you want to go from here, but just to kind of tie Troy back in. I think when we first connected, I saw a visit to the fire station. So kind of walk me through that.
Yeah. So it helps that Layla has and Ali have a mutual friend who's one of our chiefs in the fire department. So, you know, like Amanda called me the night of the accident wanting to know information, and it's the same type of thing. But she's kind of been the department liaison, I guess. Kind of with between your family and the department, which whenever there's something like this, like you alluded to earlier, you know, whenever we do have a save and, you know, a cardiac arrest survivor, we always do try to incorporate them and bring them back to the fire station and let them meet the crew. And that's all part of, you know, like the mental health aspect of the closure, you know, of allowing, our folks to see that and to meet that person and to validate everything that they did. And it's also great for the survivors to come back. And a lot of them do, you know, want to meet the crews that worked on them. So that day happened. You know, we were able to coordinate that where it took some challenges. I think it was during the summertime and everybody was off, and there was such a larger response to this call, because not only was there were two rescues, there were two engines, there was the helicopter people. So I think you had to meet everybody over a few different visits, right? But you got to meet the dispatcher, you know, Dana, who is, the dispatchers are for sure the first responders, because they often get forgotten about, but they are the ones that they're the first call, and they set the table and make sure that the right resources get rolling and provide any of that pre-arrival instruction stuff. So, you know, our department has made it a point to invite them as well, because they, more than we do even, they just hang up the phone and go on and take the next call, and they oftentimes don't get to follow up on, you know, the outcomes. Just like us, you know, we don't very rarely. Layla is a very unique case out of all, you know, patients like in her situation and even in, you know, cardiac arrest, it's not very common that we get to follow up and actually meet somebody who was as critically injured or sick as Layla. That's not normal. That's not like, you know, there are the stories you hear about, but they don't happen. They're very few and far between. So, yep. So Layla and Ali and the whole crew got together at the fire station. I recall that there was some dancing being done. I don't know how many thousands of likes and views that got on YouTube, but I'm sure it was some.
It was on a few channels.
It went viral. But yeah, and that happened a couple times. You know, we've gotten together a few times, you know, for different things of just like, you know, Layla was a celebrity at school. She's kind of the celebrity within the fire department, you know, and you know, people who don't even know Layla and people who have never weren't even on her call refer to her by name, you know, and they'll call me and ask about her, you know, throughout the year, you know, and, you know, so it's good for us to see that because we don't see that, you know, we don't get that, that closure a lot of the times. And it's something that, you know, it, like I said before, it gives us the reason to continue training so hard and, you know, always staying on top of things, because if there were no survivors, then it, like you said, it's like, you know, why are we doing this? So.
When you mentioned dispatchers, I mean, that they are the unsung heroes of the fire service, hands down.
They are. And they, you know, they're truly the first responders, and they lose, you know, a sense or two while they're at it. Not only can they not see what's going on, they can now, I guess there's some cool technology where you can FaceTime 911 in some places, but they're trying to deal with everything over the phone, and it's usually not a very calm person. You know, it's a hysterical caller on the other end that they're trying to calm down so they can understand, find out what's going on, and then get the right resources going. And in our system, the same dispatchers, there's, you know, many of them in one room, but the person that's talking to me, responding to the call, is either on the phone with the caller or sitting right next to the person that is, you know, they're talking together. So if I have a question, they can relay, and you can just tell in their voice a lot of times when we go to these calls, like I could tell in Dana's voice, and Dana's a very proactive dispatcher where she's going to start the right resources, whether I ask for it or not. And not every dispatcher does that, but she's been doing it long enough to where she knows, okay, we need to get the trauma hawk on standby for this call, and or we need to start another rescue or another EMS cat, whatever it is. And she doesn't get excited. But for Layla's, I could tell the tone of her voice was a little bit more stressed than normal. So that obviously you read into that when I can hear, you know, I know most of the dispatchers, and whenever you hear a change like that, that kind of is one of the I guess it is a verbal cue, but I don't even think about it. It's something that something's off here. You know, this is going to be the real deal.
Well, the thing with the dispatchers as well, if you and I go and work a code or an extrication, you have all that adrenaline, but then you have that physical exertion. They sit in the chair.
Correct.
They just hang up.
Correct.
And all of that.
They hang up and go right on to the next one. And a lot of times we know the outcome. You know, we were there. So even though in Layla's case, she proved me wrong, thankfully. but the outcome is something that we usually have, and we have that closure at least, or we'll follow up with the hospital, but the dispatchers don't. So, you know, I always try now to if there is a positive outcome, you know, most of the time, I think the dispatchers just assume, you know, it's not a positive outcome either. But, you know, when there is one, I want to let them know. So I'll make a phone call and talk to them and just say, just so you know, you know, we got pulses back or whatever the situation is. But I'll be completely honest, the people that asked me about Layla's call, you know, that night and even the weeks after, I wasn't optimistic. And I think that's just doing this job long enough has kind of just, I don't know if it's hardened me or made me a pessimist or whatever. You know, I wasn't hopeful that, you know, we're going to see the Layla we see today, you know, walking, talking, doing backflips. You know, I followed a Facebook page and I watched, and, you know, just as, you know, Amanda would come into the office and she would, you know, talk to me, and I'd be like, okay, yeah, I'm following, but I'm still wasn't 100% optimistic as to exactly, you know, how remarkable of a recovery Layla was going to make.
Well, speaking of that, Layla, when something like this happens and someone emerges, you know, victorious, for lack of a better word, whether it's a mental health struggle, whether it's a physical health struggle, more often than not, they become a kind of beacon for other people that are going through that. Did you find yourself in a position where you were able to help other families that maybe had some children that were injured?
Yeah, we've helped two. Well, I've helped.
You've been with me. Well, two. We've helped 25 families, but two, she got to be really hands-on with. But tell them about your first time seeing Nathan.
Do I go into detail?
Yeah.
Okay. What's his last name? Oh. Nathan is a kid. He's 23,
24. I think he's 22 now.
I don't know.
Doesn't matter.
22. And he, my mom, when she like found out about the call or found out about the like, case.
Accident.
Yeah. And she found out about it. She like warned me and told me that like, prepared me that it's going to be a lot. Like, I may not be able to handle it, that if I need to leave the room, I can, all this stuff. And then we went to his room, and he was in the bed. Was he sleeping the first time?
He was eyes open but unconscious. Like, it's kind of like I described.
And, like, we walked in. I could just, like, tell she was, like, waiting for me to, like, break down or, like, freak out. And, like, I see everyone as, like, the same person. Because, like, personally, like, when I was, like, in a wheelchair or, when I was in the bed, I wouldn't want to be treated like I'm 5 or, like, just, like, I'm, like, unable to do stuff. So I treat everyone the same because, like, I wouldn't want to be treated like that. I would hate it. So, like, me personally, I know how I would feel. Maybe they wouldn't feel the same. But it's, like, still, I'm going to do that where I'm going to act like they're awake and talking to me and, like, yeah.
The families appreciated it, though, because I wasn't sure how she would take it. She wanted to come. She wanted to help. They're still friends to this day.
Yeah.
Palm Beach County ran that call, too, and did an amazing job. And he, like, I think that's what he loves about Layla. She doesn't treat him like someone with a brain injury or someone with a disability. And she just roughs him up. She's super rough with him to the point where I'm like, easy. You know, you're going to hurt him. And his mom is like, he loves it. Are you kidding? She treats him like a normal person where most people don't. You know, then you have Layla who's like trying to make him make some more of those videos where she's shoving him or playing with him. But she has like a real calling for it. I'm like, it's scary because you don't know what she's going to do sometimes. But
I know what I'm capable of.
You do. But it's been cool to see her give back, you know, to those people and, you know, kind of like, because it's scary on the other side of this, especially when you're, you know, we're only 2 years out. And it's probably the first 2 years are, they say, are the hardest. We just had a really remarkable recovery. So we try to like help the ones who don't. It doesn't typically end like this.
I think it's just a beautiful element of hope, though. It doesn't mean that the other people are guaranteed to be able to get through that journey. But, you know, the belief side is part of healing. You know, I mean, the body is incredible. And it's funny because when I was younger, going into science, we were told once brain tissue is dead, it's dead. That's it. You know, if you have a concussion or whatever, that's it. You know, if nerves are severed, that's it. And now you see, no, you were wrong. Nerves can regenerate. Brain can, you know, regenerate. So now you add that belief, you know, if someone's has that minute potential of actually surviving, and you add that element of hope, like Layla's story, and that might be the just that minute difference between not surviving and surviving.
Yeah. And I think a lot of recovery, and I share this with a lot of the families, a lot of the recovery is in the hands of the caretakers or whoever is taking care of that person, where I'm like, the more involved you are, the more, you know, we were super involved in her recovery. We like did so much, anything they taught us or trained us, we were going to run and do it with Layla. So it was almost like we were constantly working with her. She was, you know, she's easy to train because she was usually pretty eager to do it. But it's so much is on the caretakers where I just stress that I know it's hard. I know you feel beaten. You just want to like crawl into the corner and cry, but cry later, you know, while they need you, like you just got to do the work. You have to work and you have to work them. And then, yeah, you're going to break down, but a lot of it falls in the hands of the caretakers and what you're willing to do for, you know, your person. Like it plays a big role in it. It really does.
Well, Layla, speaking of all the medical professionals that you interacted with, you kind of touched on this at the beginning. What has that inspired you as far as your career journey?
I can't go into the detail of that, but like, I just want to be like them, and I see how they like help other people, and like, I've like been able to watch them like do their jobs. I know they're not really doing much, but like, you don't understand. Like, it's a lot. It's like me. And I just see like the little things that go into it. And I just like want to like study that and like learn everything they're doing and be able to like replicate what they're doing.
And with your own style, because you definitely have your own style. Yeah.
And what about from the athletic point of view? I mean, you're still passionate about cheer. So where do you hope to go in a few years?
I hope to win worlds. Yep, I'm being dead serious. I want to win worlds.
She's technically allowed to be doing all those flips.
I got cleared. What are you talking about? I got cleared. Thank you very much. I went to my neurologist, and I wrote him a whole thing in my notes app about why I should be cleared, and like convinced him. Sorry. He wrote me a note that like basically.
Great, she was tumbling for a year before he gave her that letter.
We're not supposed to admit that, but I'm saying then I wrote him all those notes, whatever, and then he basically cleared me, but he said like with restrictions. But I have an appointment in June, and I'm gonna get fully cleared, and I'm gonna go back to cheer, and I'm gonna win worlds. Like saying it right here, I'm going to win worlds. Mm-hmm.
You heard it here first.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then, Ali, let's talk about the book. So you mentioned about emerging, being coming out of a coma. So talk to me about the book that you've written to, you know, talk about everything we've talked about today.
Yeah. So it's basically when this happened. It was Amanda, who we were discussing earlier, our mutual friend. She created a Facebook page for like the news to go out about what was going on with Layla. I had no intentions of even writing on the page. Amanda was going to get those messages out with the updates. And it was right around day three. I just wanted to write it myself. They had formed like a whole prayer vigil under her window. And it meant a lot to me. So I wanted to be able to get on there and say thank you and give my own update, which that ended up, I wrote, you know, 58 consecutive posts through the course of it. And that was really the amount, like the 58 plus the 3 days from the day we started to the day she walked out of the Shepherd Center. And a lot of it was just me being super vulnerable, what this felt like, what was happening, you know, the way it was impacting people. And I kept hearing over and over, you know, when it was over, even during it, you should really write a book. And I kind of laughed. I was like, I'm in finance. I'm not an English person. I like to read. That was it. So I finally just, once we were home, not right away, it was probably like 6 months after we were home, I'm like, I'm going to do it. Cause there was so many people that, you know, like me, you have no idea what you're stepping into when your person has a brain injury. Like it's, again, I keep comparing it to what you think because of the TV or movies, and it's not like that. So I really, and it's raw and it's super, you know, it's for some people, it's hard to read, especially if you know her, cause the beginning days were really tough. So it kind of takes you through my day by day because I had it all journaled because of that Facebook page. So it's basically those journal entries with a little bit more stuff that I didn't release to the world then, you know, because it was just, I tried to keep everyone as positive as we wanted them to be. And we still had hope for Layla. But so it kind of just takes you through that, you know, the first 2 months from when it started to when she walked out. And I hope it gives people hope. You know, the brain injury people that have read it, some of them I knew, some of them found us online, have really enjoyed it and been like, it's really accurate, you know, what you're living and what you're feeling and the emotions you go through. And there was like no books on it either. And that was something I like to read. So I kept asking nurses and doctors, like, how is there no books on this? Like someone's personal story. There was like one and it was written like 30 years ago and it was super outdated. And it was from, it was a spouse. So in my case, it's my daughter. And a lot of times it is, you know, your kid that did something to cause the brain injury. So I just thought, okay, I guess I'm going to be the one that writes it. And I did. And it was really healing to write it. I felt like to relive it again was hard, but I knew how it ended. So it was a little easier, you know, talking about it the second time around.
And just one more kind of topic, prevention, before we go to some closing questions. If you could relive it, I mean, what happened, you know, and advice was given and, you know, choices were made, but between, you know, not pointing the fingers or blame or anything like that, but if you could redo that day, what would be done differently or maybe weeks prior to maybe avoid that accident happening?
She's pretty tough. You know, she doesn't really take no well for an answer. So I even said this in the book. I said, I wish I made her come that day. I knew when she started to argue, I don't want to come. And it was like a very rare day when my whole family was available and we were going to the beach and it was all I wanted. And I knew if I argue with her, she'll come. She'll probably be mad at me for the first hour of it. We're going to fight. I didn't want to ruin that family day with a fight. And I should have chosen the fight. You know, I think of that all the time. Why didn't you choose the fight? But I didn't, you know, I was tired. I didn't want to argue with her. So that's what I probably, because it would have stopped the whole thing. She would have been in my car, you know, heading down there versus bored crashing ATVs.
But from the actual ATV point, I mean, a vehicle is obviously appropriate in certain conditions, environments, certain, you know, safety gear, etc., because we can't watch over our children the whole time. And obviously we have to loosen the apron strings, otherwise they end up being completely bonkers because we've helicopter parented them. So there is that middle ground. And when you're a first responder, it's even more terrifying because you see the things that happen out there. But are there any things, you know, for an ATV owner or anything, someone that might potentially be using that maybe could have resulted in just a fun ride versus an accident?
We saw a lot of people at that brain rehab. I would say like a good 25% were just ATVs. So this is happening a lot on those things. Way more than I had realized. I knew that, you know, the house she was at, they had one. We didn't really stress it enough. We didn't really understand them, I guess, and how common injury was with them. She should have never been riding it in a development on a street. You know, that was the first thing. Yes, of course she should have had the helmet on. But it's because I'm not against ATVs. I think they're great. They're fun if they're in the right environment and situation. Like if she was in a big open field, like in a place that's kind of designed for this, that would have been fine. She was in a community. She should have never been riding it on a like a residential road. That was her first mistake, was that. So that's really what I tell people. Be aware. I know that people treat them like they're toys. They're not toys. Same thing with golf carts. I'm like, you need to really be aware. We saw so many head injuries at that hospital, and you don't end up at the Shepherd Center unless you have a major head injury, and a ton of it was ATVs and golf carts. Like that really did shock me. I was like, these things are so much more dangerous than I thought, you know, and we still hear about them now all the time of how common it is, how frequent. I mean, we have a little boy that he's not little, he's in high school, but he's paralyzed, you know, it was an ATV. He jumped off the back of an ATV. So I think it's just the nature of them. You get on them and you think I'm invincible or nothing's going to hurt me on these things. And I was guilty of it too. Like I didn't really get it until my daughter was the consequence of that, you know, carefreeness with them, but they're machines, you know, they're like cars. A lot of them go as fast as cars. This one in particular did. You know, so you really just environment to me was everything. Like I'd still let her get on one. I mean, it would probably be hard at first, but in the right environment, like I'm all about like the right environment and the right precautions and maybe someone who, I don't know how to ride them. So I wouldn't teach her to do it. She would probably need someone who understood them better than me.
Yeah. And I think it's just an important takeaway. You know, this happened. What else can we learn that may prevent someone else in the future? Troy, is there anything you want to add to that particular topic?
No, I mean, everything that she just said, it's such a common call. And maybe it's, you know, again, the general public probably doesn't hear about every time. But that's a call that I get dispatched to weekly, you know, in certain areas more than most, especially in the area that this accident happened. My battalion it was very, very common. Not so much in the neighborhood, like Ali said, but I can't tell you how many ATV and motorcycle accidents. The helmets are key, you know. The brain, like we there's so much we don't know about it, but we do know that with a helmet you're going to fare better than without. Yeah, it's an extremely common accident that unless you're doing this and responding to those types of calls, you probably don't know about as it's that common.
Absolutely. Well, staying on you, Troy, if people want to reach out to you online, where are the best places?
So my Facebook is kind of closed. I keep that private. They won't know who I am. They can friend request me if they want. And they can just look me up. But best way, I can give you my email address, my personal email, which is very easy. It's Troy Deschard, just as it's spelled, at outlook.com. That's my my personal email. And just let me know if you have any questions. That's the easiest way to get in touch with me.
Brilliant. All right, Ali, yourself and then the book. Where can people find those?
Both kind of in the same place. She started an Instagram page is probably the best way. And it's Layla's_TBI_journey. You can also see a lot of pictures of the stuff we're describing on there. And then there is a link for the book on there as well. And the email, if you wanted to email me, that's on there at the top.
Excellent. And then Layla, we found out where we can reach out to you on Instagram. How can people get you Chick-fil-A, Bolle, or Starbucks vouchers and Venmo? Oh. I told you I'd put it in.
How could they? Let me think on that. What?
I mean, you probably have to.
I don't want to release my number.
But they can message you on the Instagram, yeah, if someone wanted to send something to you.
Yeah, the Instagram, the Layla's TBI one, not my main one. TBI one. You can send it out to me on there. Or...
That's a good
one. Don't I have an email to the account?
I monitor that whole thing, yeah.
To the account? Mm-hmm. So you can use my email.
It's on the Instagram. It's Layla's.
It's on Layla's the link in the bio, isn't it? Yeah.
Link in description.
There we go.
I would love Starbucks, Bolle, Chick-fil-A's, and because I'm not as obsessed anymore, but Starbucks and Bolle, I will love you forever. You I'm actually going to Starbucks after this.
There we go. You got to get a fresh kitchen, though. Like I said, I know there's one in Davie. So if you're further south, you got to hit that up.
I'm there, so I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. We have to go there.
All right.
It's as good as today.
It's better.
I'm trusting you.
Yeah, let me know. All right. Well, I just want to say thank you so much. It's been an incredible conversation to kind of hear just obviously some short elements about where you guys were before this happened and, you know, your journey into, you know, certain professions and then the impact of this on all of you, you know, and then the professionalism from the EMS and hospital side. And obviously, as you said, the caretaking elements, the sibling elements, and then Layla's, you know, strength and courage and journey that she's been through. So I want to thank you all so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. Yeah,